From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Boston comes together in record numbers for the city's marathon. We have reaction from the event and the latest on the trial of the suspected bomber.
We see articles that there's hundreds of cameras and we're counting them. We see them ourselves too. We get the three nephews counting all the cameras that the surveillance ones, so we feel safe here.
Also today, President Obama heads to Asia, kicking off his four-day trip to re-energize U.S. ties in the region. And outspoken Pakistani journalist Hamid Mir is shot several times, just months after he told FSN Reports of the dangers his profession faced.
We are helpless and it's very difficult for us to continue this profession. But we are doing that and we are hopeful that one day the government will be able to provide us security.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The United Nations mission in South Sudan has condemned what it says were targeted ethnic killings after rebel forces seized the town of Benchu last week. This comes amidst escalating violence in the country despite a ceasefire signed earlier this year. Ira Spitzer has more from the UN headquarters in New York.
According to a statement released by the UN, victims were targeted based on their ethnicity or nationality, including more than 200 people sheltering in a mosque who were killed after rebel forces seized the oil-rich town. The UN mission also decried the use of hate speech over the radio. Thousands of people have been killed in the fighting when soldiers loyal to the country's former vice president, Riek Machar, took up arms against government forces. Machar is an ethnic Nuer, while President Salva Kiir is an ethnic Dinka.
36,000 people are running in the Boston Marathon today amid tighter security following last year's bombings. Three people were killed and hundreds injured last April in the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil since 9/11. Nick Harper reports from Boston.
A million people are expected on the streets of Boston to watch this year's marathon, twice the usual number. But that increased support also comes with increased security. Marathon director Dave McGillivray has promised the city will be the safest place on the planet. Double the amount of police will patrol the race route, 3,500 in total. They'll be using the 100 newly installed surveillance cameras to monitor the city, and on top of that, no backpacks, strollers or costumes for the runners or spectators.
The president of South Korea, Park Yun-hai, has said the actions of the crew of the stricken ferry that capsized were akin to murder. She said the crew must take civil and criminal responsibility for their actions. Her condemnation comes following the arrest of 69-year-old Captain Lee Jun-suk and two other crew members on charges including negligence of duty and violation of maritime law. It's reported that the captain and crew did not follow standard evacuation procedures, telling the passengers, the majority of them school children on a class trip, to stay put as the ferry sank. It's also been revealed that a junior crew member lacking experience was at the helm when the problems began. At least 64 people are known to be dead, with about 238 still missing. Rescue teams are in the process of recovering bodies of those who perished from the sunken ferry. Russia is accusing the Ukrainian government of reneging on last week's agreement struck in Geneva that was supposed to pave the way for a de-escalation of the crisis between the two countries. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the Ukrainians have failed to implement key parts of the agreement. He called the government in Kiev extremists. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is visiting Ukrainian government officials in Kiev for talks. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Iran has condemned the U.S. decision to seize a New York skyscraper owned by a nonprofit Persian and Islamic cultural organization with alleged links to the Iranian government. Tehran denies any links to the Alavi Foundation, who control much of the 36-story building, calling the seizure illegal. William Denzelo reports from New York.
Following last year's federal court decision that the skyscraper could be confiscated, the United States Justice Department has agreed to give proceeds from the building's sale to victims of Iran-backed militants. The court ruled that the building could be seized on the grounds that concealing Iranian assets is a violation of U.S. sanctions. Iran says the seizure violates religious freedom, with a spokesperson for their foreign ministry saying Saturday that the decision raises doubts about the credibility of U.S. justice.
U.S. President Barack Obama is heading to Asia on a four-nation tour aimed at reinvigorating his commitment to the region. He'll visit Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines after previously planned visits to the region were postponed. Fresh violence erupted in Venezuela over the weekend. The capital, Caracas, was the scene of riots between police forces and opponents to the administration of President Nicolas Maduro. Chaos erupted in an upscale neighborhood of Caracas, where 8 people were reported injured. Andrea Arenas reports.
Masked protesters held a rally they called the Resurrection of Democracy, where they burned figurines dressed up as President Maduro. But while activists in Caracas demanded the president's removal from office, people in lower-income neighborhoods on the outskirts of the city showed support for the current government and burned dummies resembling opposition leader Enrique Capriles. The student-led protests began in February with demands for the government to tackle the country's high crime rate, inflation, as well as food shortages.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. A record number of runners, some 36,000, laced up for this year's Boston Marathon today, including many who were directly affected by last year's deadly bombing. Police in their thousands, bolstered by the National Guard, provided an unprecedented level of security for athletes and spectators alike. The finish line, last year a scene of chaos and bloodshed, saw celebrations as an American, for the first time in decades, took first place in the men's event. FSN's Nick Harper has this report.
The sounds of a city in celebration. This is the finish line of the Boston Marathon. The sidewalks packed with thousands of people cheering as runners complete the grueling 26.2 miles. It's a very different sound to last year's race. Two homemade bombs detonated just before 3 o'clock. They'd been built to cause maximum damage. Pressure cookers filled with ball bearings and sharp pieces of metal. Runners were still finishing. Many had families and friends watching. 3 people died, 16 people lost limbs, and more than 260 others were injured. One of those killed was Lingzhi Lu, a Chinese student studying at Boston University. This year, the marathon set aside 7 places for her friends to run in her honour. Xu Hong Ling and Yu Jie Wang both felt it was important to run today's race for Lingzhi.
Seeing how the community have come together in the aftermath, it says a lot about a city. So I think it's a great way to continue Lingzhi's legacy.
Only if she could see like how much impact she has made in this community and how much inspiration she has brought to us, like runners running this year's marathon.
As well as being one of the world's most prestigious races, Marathon Monday is a day the whole city comes out to celebrate. Boston University's Dean of Students, Ken Elmore, still finds it hard to understand why such a day was targeted.
The marathon is a day about young people, about youth. People from all over the world with their, I don't care how old you are a young person. You're coming with that youthful spirit and energy to chat with people who might be from anywhere in the world. And so the irony of it is that young people attacked that.
This year, the police presence has been significantly stepped up. Twice the number of officers patrolled the race route, 3,500 in total. In the run-up, marathon director Dave McGilray pledged the city on race day would be the safest place on the planet. On top of that, no backpacks, strollers or costumes, something that's impacted charity runner Brian Keeney. He was nearing the finish line when the bombs went off last year, dressed as a hamburger. It's an outfit he knows slowed him down, and he thinks perhaps enough to save his life.
I ran 25 and a half miles in this, and I was 5 minutes away from the bombings when they happened. And I can't say for sure, I don't know how much faster I would have run had I not had the burger, but if it was 5 minutes faster, I could have been exactly there. No costumes this year. People worry they might stick something in here, something that shouldn't be there. So this is really not the year to stick your nose up at the rules.
The city this year had 100 new surveillance cameras installed. People in Boston say that they'd certainly noticed the tighter security.
We see articles that there's hundreds of cameras and we're counting them. We see them ourselves, too. We get the 3 nephews counting all the cameras that the surveillance ones, so we feel safe here.
I'm sure the security is going to be way more intense than last year. So hopefully it'll be a nice marathon this year.
But last year's events didn't put people off. This was the second largest Boston Marathon, with 9,000 extra runners and more than 1 million spectators, double the usual number. Boston wanted to show that as runners crossed the finish line, where those bombs exploded 12 months ago, this was not only the sound of personal achievements, but the collective sound of a city that's overcome. Nick Harper, Boston.
The Boston Marathon bombing suspect, Jukar Sanayev, is due to stand trial for murder this November. The 20-year-old pleaded not guilty to 30 charges, including 17 that carry the death penalty. His older brother, Tamerlan, died during a police shootout following last year's attack. FSN's Nick Harper spoke to me about the details of the trial.
We now know that Jukar Sanayev is due to stand trial on the 3rd of November, and in many ways, this is now the next big milestone. We've had the one-year anniversary of the bombings. That was last Tuesday. We've had the first marathon since the bombings. So now everyone's beginning to concentrate more on the court case. Jukar Sanayev, he's charged with 30 counts, 17 of them carry the death penalty. He's pleaded not guilty to all of those charges. And it's alleged that he and his older brother, Tamerlan, carried out these attacks. Of course, Tamerlan was killed in a police shootout in the days following the bombings. The prosecution say that they have video showing Sanayev placing a backpack near to the finish line that exploded just a few moments after he walked away from it. And they also say that they have this note that he wrote just before he was captured, saying that he'd carried out the attacks in response for US wars in Muslim countries. He wrote, "I can't stand to see so much evil go unpunished."
Sarnaev's defence lawyer has quite a reputation. She's handled some major cases in her time.
Absolutely, yes. Public defender Judy Clark, she's represented some of the biggest terrorist criminals in the US, including the Unabomber and also Jared Luffner, who carried out the attack in Tucson, Arizona, targeting Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. So really what they're going to try and do is humanize Jukar Sanayev as much as possible. They'll want to show that he was the impressionable younger brother and that his older brother, Tamerlan, was really the driving force behind this attack. They're therefore going to try and limit the blame against Jukar. Even his defence team last week, they were in court asking the judge to try and hand over records that the prosecution have about Zanayev's older brother Tamerlan. The thinking is that he was radicalised some years ago and was therefore instrumental in carrying out the attacks.
And in terms of the prosecution's case, will they be going for that death penalty? Is there an appetite? Do we sense that that's what the public would like to see?
Well, the prosecution have said that they will seek the death penalty. 17 of those 30 charges carry the death penalty. However, it is slightly tricky. They're aiming for the federal death penalty because the state of Massachusetts here abolished the death penalty back in 1984. And we have to remember that a panel of jury members will decide whether or not Zanayev, if he's found guilty, will face the death penalty. And there's a thinking that Boston and Massachusetts is a liberal-leaning area. It's largely Catholic. And as a result, many people don't seem to favour the death penalty. In fact, a poll taken by the Boston Globe back in September last year found that 57% of people supported a life sentence for Sanayev if he was found guilty, but only 33% said that they would support the death penalty. So even if he's found guilty, it's not clear at this stage whether or not he will actually be executed.
Nick Harper in Boston. This is FSN Reports. President Obama is aiming to re-energise his Asia strategy with a four-nation tour to Japan, South Korea, Malaysia and the Philippines. Ahead of Tuesday's visit, the Senior Director for Asian Affairs with Mr. Obama's National Security Council, Evan Medeiros, says the White House remains fully committed to its foreign policy pivot to Asia.
The United States is all in when it comes to the Asia-Pacific, and we're there for the long haul. This is a result of a calculation of our economic and our security interests. It's not a geopolitical fad. It's not a political expediency. It's about protecting American economic interests, security interests, and continuing to build our people-to-people ties that we've had for many decades in the Asia Pacific.
The White House says it's part of a so-called rebalancing of America's economic, diplomatic, and security policy towards the region, and compensates for the cancellation of a previously planned trip last year. But Mr. Obama will have a tricky tightrope to walk, as Lorna Shaddock reports.
America's Pacific Century. That was the headline written by Hillary Clinton back in 2011 for an article used to tout the Obama administration's new policy of rebalancing, or pivoting, as she put it, towards the Asia Pacific. This is how the current U.S. Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker describes the strategy.
In the first decade of this century, as we fought two costly wars, our diplomatic, economic, and strategic resources were overinvested in certain regions of the world and underinvested in others. During the early days of this administration, President Obama made a deliberate and strategic decision to correct this imbalance and to deepen U.S. engagement with the world's fastest growing region, the Asia Pacific.
But these days, it seems to be the feeling among many Asian leaders that you're more likely to hear the camera shutters clicking at the current Secretary of State in Europe, as on Thursday, sorting out the Ukraine crisis, or shuttling back and forth between the Israelis and Palestinians, than you are to see him concentrating on events in Asia. That, they say, tells the real story about US foreign policy priorities. And of course, politics at home hasn't helped. The US government shutdown meant Mr. Obama had to cancel a long-planned trip to Asia last autumn, leading some in the region to question the whole idea of the rebalance. Here's Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at Washington's Brookings Institution.
It sort of fell apart, or at least floundered, as most of the major people behind it left the administration, and Obama himself had to cope with sequestration, meaning big defense budget cuts, and then, of course, the shutdown, which led to his cancellation of his trip last fall to Asia. And you put it all together, and the oomph sort of went out of the rebalance.
The United States.
There you go. That's me.
Today I say to you, and I say to everybody, that the United States of America is with you.
That was the president speaking in Burma on his last Asia trip back in 2012. This time round, he'll be focusing more on his host's concerns about a rising China, especially in Tokyo and Seoul. He'll be reassuring them that the Pentagon will have 60% of its naval and air force assets in the region by 2020. But he'll also have to tread carefully in order to avoid a flare-up in relations with Beijing, which is convinced the Asia pivot is about containing its influence. Michael O'Hanlon says this means a change of language.
Pivot implies that you're turning away from traditional allies. It implies that you're getting in China's face more than we necessarily want the Chinese to feel. The term pivot's not a good one. But it is possible if you think of this as a rebalancing, as a new equilibrium in which our focus on East Asia is again comparable to our focus on the broader Middle East and now to Europe and Crimea and Ukraine as well. And that should be feasible.
Feasible and necessary. The Obama administration sees the region as an important area of economic growth and hopes the trip will give added impetus to the ongoing negotiations about a Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Here's Penny Pritzker, the Commerce Secretary, again.
We absolutely will continue to forge more of our resources in a region that includes nearly 60% of global GDP, the world's fastest growing economies, half of the world's population, and an emerging middle class hungry for American products and services.
And meanwhile, it's not just Mr. Obama whose reputation is at stake. As Hillary Clinton mulls a presidential run in 2016, her supporters have cited the Asia strategy as one of her biggest achievements as Secretary of State. America's long-term foreign policy strategy may hinge on the success of rebalancing to Asia, but so too, in part, may Ms. Clinton's presidential ambitions. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
Now, in a case that could shake up global markets and international relations, the Cayman Islands hedge fund NML Capital and the government of Argentina faced off today before the US Supreme Court. Our Capitol Hill correspondent Alice Olstein, who is at this morning's hearing, reports that even though the South American nation's default hurt investors, the Obama administration warned a ruling for the hedge fund could come back to bite the US and hurt countries around the world.
A decades-long international battle over tens of billions of dollars came before the nation's highest court today, The Republic of Argentina complained that a lower court ruling allowing a hedge fund to investigate their assets around the world went too far, as it included everything from the private property of former presidents to military equipment. The lawyer for Argentina, Jonathan Blackman, told FSN after the hearing that a ruling against the nation could have global repercussions.
This case is not about Argentina. It's about the protecting all countries from intrusive, overreaching discovery of the kind that would, according to the other side, cover military assets, diplomatic assets, and other things that should be outside the scope of any enforcement powers by a U.S. court.
The U.S. Justice Department agreed and argued before the court Wednesday that because the U.S. has defaulted on some of its debt, too, and could do so again in the future, the government is worried that allowing a bank to go after Argentine assets could come back to haunt them. Blackman explained,
"The United States is a litigant in courts also, and it doesn't want to set any precedent that this sort of discovery that's sweeping and unbounded and covers all kinds of sensitive things should be permitted."
The controversy dates back to 2001, when Argentina went through a severe economic crisis and defaulted on about $80 billion worth of debt. Most of the bondholders around the world later agreed to a restructuring of that debt, in which they'd get paid back less than a third of the original amount. But the hedge fund NML Capital demanded to be paid in full, even though they bought up the debt for pennies on the dollar. When Argentina refused, they started suing in U.S. courts to force the bank to turn over information about everything of value anywhere in the world connected to the country. Examples that came up in Monday's arguments were butcher shops in Italy with delicious Argentine beef, Air Force planes, and the personal homes of diplomats. 2 years ago, the hedge fund even tried to seize a historic ship of Argentina's, ironically named Libertad, or Liberty, that was in Ghana on a goodwill tour. Backers of NML Capital say these actions are both legal and necessary.
Argentina agreed to pay its debts and now doesn't want to, and that's just not the way our legal system works.
That's Richard Samp, chief counsel of the Washington Legal Foundation, which is supporting NML Capital in this case. He told FSN that Argentina opened itself up to being sued when it borrowed money in the first place, and anything other than full repayment could hurt the global economy.
If creditors come to believe that they will never be able to collect on judgments from foreign sovereigns, then of course they're not going to be willing to lend to foreign sovereigns in the future. So it's important for the courts to be willing to enforce these judgments. And if they don't, lenders will not use New York in the future as a place to lend their money.
But France, Mexico, Brazil, and dozens of economists and church groups disagree, warning that such a ruling would make it more difficult for countries around the world struggling with heavy debt. Eric LeCompte with the faith-based social justice group Jubilee USA said average low-income citizens would be hit the hardest.
According to international laws that also passed in the United States, when a country receives that relief, that money is supposed to go to build infrastructure, build schools, provide medicine, build critical infrastructure that helps those living in extreme poverty. And that's where the millions and often billions of dollars when debt relief is received by a country is supposed to go towards. But once they receive that money, then these holdout creditors or these predatory hedge funds who had bought up some debt for pennies on the dollar can now go to a U.S. court and say, well, look, we can go and collect that money.
A ruling is expected this summer. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Outspoken Pakistani TV host Hamid Mir was shot several times near a Karachi airport at the weekend. He's now undergoing treatment for his wounds. The US condemned the shooting, calling it the latest in a series of worrisome attacks on journalists in the country. So far this year, five people have been killed, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. And just a few months ago, Hamid Mir spoke to FSN Reports about just how dangerous he felt his job had become.
Yes, Pakistan is one of the most dangerous places for the media. I can give you my own example. From last couple of months, I am not sleeping at my home. I changed my place after 2-3 days. I am forced to send my children out of Pakistan. I have not even allowed my wife to live with me. The Taliban and the intelligence agencies, they are also threatening me. I'm not the only one in Pakistan. A lot of other journalists, they are also facing the same kind of situation. We are in the crossfire. We are facing threats both from the intelligence agencies and the Taliban and the other militants. And in the last 10 years, more than 95 Pakistani journalists have been killed. They were assassinated. They were kidnapped, and then their dead bodies were thrown on the roads. Vulnerable place in Pakistan for the media is the Balochistan province, where there is no writ of the state. Then the Pakistani tribal areas, very, very dangerous for the Pakistani journalists. Even in the capital, Islamabad, where I live and from where I am talking. So the problem is that the government of Pakistan is failed to provide any kind of security to journalists. Every day, some senior journalists, they contact me. We talk to each other about the threats. And, you know, we are helpless. And it's very difficult for us to continue this profession. But we are doing that, and we are hopeful that one day the government will be able to provide us security.
So almost a year to the day, you yourself were the target of an attempted assassination. If you could just tell me about that particular incident.
In November 2012, a bomb was planted under my car, and the reason was that the Taliban attacked Malala Yousafzai, a young girl who is campaigning for the girls' education, and the Taliban attacked her, and I supported her on my show on Jio television, and then they sent me a letter that they will target me, and after some days, a bomb was planted under my car, and then the Taliban accepted the responsibility. On the other side, the security agencies and some intelligence agencies, they are also not happy with the media. They also threat myself, other journalists.
Hamid, the government there has said that protecting journalists is a priority, but you're saying you don't have the confidence that that statement will be backed up with action?
You see, whenever we call upon the government to take some actions for providing security to our colleagues, they say that we are short of the funds, we are short of the security personnel, and especially our colleagues in the Balochistan province and Fatah province and the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. They are totally helpless.
Pakistani journalist Hamid Mir talking to me earlier this year. Mr. Mir is recovering in hospital after being shot several times at the weekend near Karachi. And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com, and you can always follow us on Twitter. We're there @FeatureStory. Coming up on Tuesday, the latest from day one of the US president's mission to re-energise ties in Asia. Plus, a new study in the US state of Colorado shows that there are not enough doctors to serve the population, an issue fast spreading nationwide. That's Tuesday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.